How could Attorney General Jeff Sessions' promise to get tougher on drug crimes affect Florida? A closer look just ahead. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Never miss a show, though. Download the WJCT app, listen anytime there or on iTunes, or stream us live right now on our Facebook page where we want your comments. Now, just ahead, we're going to take a look at the controversy over mandatory minimum sentences. Get on the line now and let us know what you think at 549-2937. Then later, what you need to know to protect your child's hearing, plus a busy Memorial Day weekend of events. The Spectator will fill us in all of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, Florida defendants could soon be looking at much longer prison terms. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he's ordering federal prosecutors in the Justice Department to turn back the clock to an earlier and tougher era in the four-decades-long war on drugs. Now, mandatory sentencing laws for drug users have been controversial for years, and many Republicans as well as Democrats now oppose them as unfair, ineffective, and too costly. The new Justice Department policy cancels the Obama administration's attempts to pull back on harsh sentencing strategies that had produced a big growth in the nation's prison population. Reactions to Sessions' change in course, though, has been one of alarm in the last few weeks, as critics say the new policy threatens to halt a push for bipartisan criminal justice reform in this country. One local critic is Kevin Gay. He is CEO of Operation New Hope here in Jacksonville. That's a nonprofit helping people leaving the prison system reintegrate into society. Kevin Gay joins us in studio with his thoughts on Sessions' order. Kevin, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to Attorney General Jeff Sessions' order to impose much tougher and longer sentences on drug offenders? Give us a call about mandatory minimum sentencing and what you think. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Send your tweets to @MelissaInJax. Weigh in on Facebook. Let us know what you think. Kevin, federal prosecutors sent a letter last week to defense attorneys in Jacksonville, Tampa, and Orlando, telling them they have just a couple of weeks to finalize plea deals or risk sending their clients to prison for very long terms, sometimes even life sentences. And this includes low-level drug offenders, the new policy for Attorney General Jeff Sessions. You immediately raised the alarm about this. Why are you speaking out?
Well, I guess, Melissa, I hope many are alarmed and dismayed and saddened by this recent news. I mean, if you take a look back, and you and I have had this conversation, and you've been so good over the years in raising this issue on what our criminal justice system's done to in communities like Jacksonville and across the country. But when you look back at our country and you think about what we've done over the past four decades, our incarceration rates have gone up 500%. We were at 170,000 in the early 70s, and now we're over 2.5 million men, women, and youth in our state and federal systems. Another 5 million or so in our county jails. And so what most, and this is what's been interesting about it, it's taken some time, but over the last really decade, you've seen Republicans and Democrats come together on this issue in the most bipartisan way, more than any other issue in the country, and saying that what we've been doing is not sustainable, it's killing communities, and we can be smarter on this and not think that this tough war on drugs is the best avenue. And the byproduct of that has been decimating communities. And so what Obama did and what Holder did back in 2013 was to begin to look at this in a real realistic way. And when Holder said this, and I thought this was important, and this is always the conversation that those of us that are in the reentry world say, our conversation always has to be couched first and foremost as a public safety conversation. And what Holder said, though, is that we should look at incarceration as a way to punish, deter, and to rehabilitate, but not to merely warehouse and forget. And that's what we've been doing in our country. And so the changes that he directed his prosecutors at the time were to look at the sentencing and look at individuals, and based upon their risk to community, you have the flexibility to make the determination on the sentencing guidelines. And so that meant to not have to force the mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, the three strikes and you're out. And I don't know if people, mm-hmm. Melissa, truly understand what that means. But for example, in the three strikes you're out, you could have had two charges, drug charges, when you were 17, 18 years old. 40 years later, you get caught with just possession charge, and you could fall into that mandatory minimum sentencing guideline. And people began to say, this is just unreasonable, and it's not sustainable. So to see what Sessions has done now, in light of that, to me is really an abomination of what we know is right.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Now, Sessions has departed from key figures in his own party on this who've pushed for bipartisan criminal justice reform, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, Senator Rand Paul, other key Republicans in the Senate. Former governor of Texas, Rick Perry, also pushed his state away from these types of really harsh, long penalties in the prison system. Let me ask you, though, Kevin, what about the attorney general's argument? He's saying drugs in particular, drugs like heroin, are cheaper, purer, more easily available than ever, and that we are simply not taking the threat of drug abuse and drug trafficking seriously enough in this country, and that a more punitive approach is required than what the Obama administration pursued.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's what really the intention of the rollback that we saw with Attorney General Holder was, yes, when you have a person that's going to be a threat to our communities and to our children by bringing drugs into communities, let's look at those folks and let's give them everything we have by the law from the standpoint of the penalty. And it should be punitive. But what we're saying also is that the fact that we've learned that you can blend in policy that's a smart approach, and this is kind of what I think is important. When you're looking at two young folks that are in front of a judge, two 21-year-old kids that got caught with possession, you know, the same amount of drugs, and they're over the limit, so that they obviously have committed a crime. But you look at one who has not had a record before, that has a lot of assets in play, versus somebody else that's there that's had a record of history, and all the criminological numbers are against them. They don't have family support. They don't have education. That we need to be really careful because we know the risks that are there. All that the bipartisan conversation that we've had and the logic we've had with a lot of great Republicans and Democrats over the last couple of years are, let's just use some logic and let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, which we're looking to do here.
It's striking, too, to note the degree to which the states have really pursued a different path on this. A new report from the Vera Institute of Justice. There's also a report from Harvard's Fair Punishment Project that highlights the efforts states have been making to reduce their prison populations, mainly to cut costs. The high incarceration rate has been difficult for state budgets. Now, here are some statistics. From 2009 to 2015, the state prison population across the country fell 5%. 23 states, blue and red states, have worked hard to reduce their prison populations with policy changes. They've gotten rid of the mandatory minimum sentences. They've looked at alternative punishments. And here's the key for you, Kevin. They've enhanced reentry support to minimize recidivism. Or by that, I mean people going in and out of the prison system over and over again. That's the whole idea behind Operation New Hope. Can you talk a little bit about the purpose and the mission of Operation New Hope and your part in all of this?
Well, sure. And let me touch one thing quickly, Melissa, on what you said, and I think it's really important. There has been significant policy reform in some states, very conservative states like Texas, Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, not there yet. The reform that started in Texas about 8 years ago has now led to the things you talked about, mandatory minimums, three strikes, policy reform on charges, has led to closing prisons, reducing their incarceration rates so significantly that they're saving hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, to the point, Melissa, that they had to legislatively now create a reinvestment act. And they've done this now in numerous states, saying that we're saving so much money from the cost of incarceration, we don't want to bury it in our coffers, in our state coffers. but we want to reinvest those back into the social infrastructure that will prevent these issues of mental health, substance abuse, treatment, and of course, reentry. And so when you see that working, and here's the key also, Melissa, the naysayers that say, well, you know, our deterrent system is there for a reason. Texas crime rate has continued to drop. Georgia's has continued to drop. And so, and I appreciate that, you know, our work and the work that folks like us around the country are involved in, the data is out. We have great data that shows now.
You think the Attorney General's ignoring the data?
That's the part, and I guess the part that really had got to my heart. The data now is out. We actually, with a group of folks from the Ford Foundation that funded, presented the data that we have on Capitol Hill last year. And we reported, and this is from organizations around the country, that we have some really good information now. When you use the right protocol on folks coming out, you do the assessments, you identify mental health and all of those, we can affect that.
Now, there's a lot of action in the states to try to counteract Attorney General Sessions. The liberal group ACLU has launched a plan called Smart Justice, where they're going into local district attorney races across the country to try to get them to take a stand on how they will respond to the issue of mass incarceration, trying to score victories in district races so as to have more of an impact at the state level, since more prisoners are housed through the state prison system than the federal prison system. I just wanted to point that out. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. And also, this is not a related issue, except for the fact that it involves the same public official. As we talk about the Attorney General, he's increasingly becoming the subject of scrutiny. It has been reported in the last 24 hours that he did not disclose meetings he had last year with Russian officials when he applied for his security clearance to join the administration. There are calls now on the floor of the House to hold hearings on the Attorney General and his status as the nation's top law enforcement official. So given that backdrop, what are your thoughts about how Sessions' policies are going to play out against this gathering cloud of the Russia probe?
Well, you know, it's getting interesting by the day. And Melissa, I'm not in a position to understand and get in the head of someone like Jeff Sessions, but there's something going on in the midst of all of this, and why, in light of all the data and all of the conversations and all of, you know, folks like Newt Gingrich and others who are aligning themselves on these conversations about reform and the policies that we're talking about today, why, in face of all of that, with all of the support that you would want to have as a politician, to go against it? There's definitely something in play. And, you know, and you said something earlier about the states. You know, even in Florida, a very conservative state, we've had our local folks and our delegation, Senator Bradley from Clay County and others, who have really been reviewing our mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines for drugs. We've begun the process here. And you're right, the burden of all of this is really being held in our state systems. And quite frankly, now, with some of the changes that are happening, the burden is really going to land more in our county and municipal system. Because if the states begin to say we're going to not prosecute into the state, you know, system, they're going to land in our Duval County jails as they are today.
All right, let's go to your calls now for Kevin Gay of Operation New Hope. What do you think about the change in mandatory minimum sentencing under new Attorney General Jeff Sessions? 549-2937. And we'll go to your emails and tweets and Facebook comments in just a moment. Chuck at the Beaches. Hey, Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, guys. I just wanted to mention that you have two types of people that you would be arresting. You would be arresting those who are trafficking, who are marketing the drug, and then you would be arresting the person who is suffering from the disease of addiction. And that person might be involved in theft as well to feed that addiction that they have, that they've got to have every morning. So you have those who have the disease that are dealing with other mental issues, et cetera. It makes no sense to put someone in prison for a long time who's suffering from a disease. I can understand keeping people off the street who are trafficking. And then one other thing, I have know someone whose son had gotten out of a federal prison. He had been in there for a year and a half, and he had to tell me three times. It was hard for me to believe. But when his son got out of prison, he had to be detoxed from OxyContin. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, thanks for that, Chuck.
Well, Chuck, you know, you bring up a great point, and I think that's, you know, the nexus of the conversation is looking at individuals in a different way. You've got the dealer, you've got somebody that's really, you know, taking advantage of the sickness we have. And I think we need, as a country, we've got to begin to look at the difference between a prisoner and a patient. We have a lot of folks who have been caught up in the addiction, in addictions, and we have to look at that differently. And you're right, a lot of the thefts that we see today are coming from because of that. I'll give you an example that just happened to me, Melissa, this past week. And I'm not going to use any names, but a well-known person, well thought of in our community, reached out to me that he had a Rolex watch stolen from him when he was playing golf. And so when they were able to track back how it happened and where it happened and who did it, found out it was a young kid who had an addiction issue. And when this, I don't know if many people would have been willing to do this, but when this wonderful man that you know saw this, he went to the state attorney and others and said, look, I understand that this kid's sick. I want to help him. And so that's where I think a lot of the 86% of our population now in America says we believe that these sentencing guidelines are too severe.
Bob in Grove Park. Hey, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Just like to make a comment. You know, I believe Sessions is the type of person that everything I do is good and everything everyone else does is bad if I don't do it. And all it would take is for one of his children or someone close to him to fall into a trap of some kind of possession. And then all of a sudden, watch, I bet he reverses everything. That's all. Thanks.
We want all points of view. Eric and Ortega, go ahead, Eric.
Hey, I just wanted to point out quickly the hypocrisy of the current mood around the country as it pertains to drugs. We're still at that level where we're talking about crack and heroin that affect primarily underprivileged communities as drug offenses, but you have the, you know, now the white epidemic of opioid abuse as a public health situation. And I just wanted to get a comment on that. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Okay, what about that, Kevin?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, the opioid epidemic is one that's, I think, been tearing the country apart. And I know I was on a task force that New Jersey Governor Christie had a couple years ago, because what happened, they were seeing it ahead of us, that the opioid use of young kids has then led to the epidemic of heroin. And I think we're beginning to see that part of it here. I'm excited that Lutheran Social Services of Florida, through Governor Rick Scott, the folks were just awarded a significant amount of money to address these issues. And we're working with those guys to put together, once again, a way that we can get those folks the treatment they need and get them on a pathway of getting the services and then the jobs, as opposed to getting tangled up in the system.
What about the other sort of narrative that that caller alluded to, that when the drug trade was primarily seen as affecting poor and urban communities, it was not a five-alarm fire? Now that the opioid crisis is affecting white and middle-class communities, it's a five-alarm fire. At least that's the perception certainly some Americans hold.
Well, you know, I think there is, but, you know, we go back to our original part of the conversation, Melissa. I think we've evolved so far beyond that today. I think most folks, black, white, you know, Dr. Hallett, who I know has been on your show, did a report a couple years ago.
Criminologist at UNF.
Yep, yep, absolutely. Phenomenal guy and great friend of this work. And he had a report that was really even staggering for me. He says, you know, we think that the issues of crime are black issues or in black communities. He said, no, look at the data. And you look at the poor white communities in Jacksonville, Florida, on the west side, crime's high. And so you really look at where poverty is. Poverty is a great incubator for crime. And I think America has begun to really look at that. But what we need to look at, and I think it's important to still look at the disproportionality that we see in our sentencing and who is affected by that. We know that the kids at the beach, I live at the beach, two young 15, 16-year-old kids are walking down the street. They're not just pulled over and say, hey, what are you doing? And then checked, and then if they have something on them. I think we still need to look at that, and we still need to look at why African-American sentencing guidelines are 20-30% higher than white folks. And so I think those are still a part of the disproportionality that we see in our system.
Buck is in Yulee. Hey, Buck, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, thanks so much. I have two questions. They would be, one is there a way to capture the difference between recidivism and the pure manufacture of a criminal by these long sentences? So as, you know, entering the system, there's a criminal intent, and I guess that would be recidivism, whereas entering the system with these long sentences and removing the hope of reentering society in a positive way manufactures a criminal. And then second, I'm wondering if this is a moral imperative or if this is a financial imperative. I certainly hear the strength of the financial imperative argument, but I'm concerned that we are reducing something of much greater value, that being a moral imperative, to something as, I use the word trivial, but something as trivial as a financial imperative.
Thank you, Buck.
Well, I can tell you that without a doubt, today, what I've learned that's just broken my heart over the years is, in our country is the only country in the world that does this. But in America, if you've gotten into the system at all, you realize that it's a lifetime sentence. I don't care if you have a six-month charge here and stayed in the Duval County Jail, or if you have a five-year sentence in the state system. Once you've served that, the day you walk out of a jail or a prison, sentence number two starts, and it's a lifetime sentence. So I think, to the caller's question, the impact of knowing that once you're tangled up in our system in America, we never let go. And so I think there's that. And then the other part of it, the question of the moral imperative, I say this all the time. I believe that we've looked at this as a morality issue versus a poverty issue. And I am convinced today, working with over 5,000 people that we have, when folks are given the directive and an opportunity to get that job and understand how to navigate, it's a game changer. And so I think we've made it easy. I said this when I was in front of Frank Denton in the editorial board a year or so ago, and I think it had a couple of jaws that dropped. I said, I'm going to compare our criminal justice system to what we've done in genocide in countries. And I know when you say that, you go, how in the world would you say that? But when you think about how we got to where we did in countries with genocide, we strategically demeaned a population to the point where we could do the things that we've did to them. We did it in Germany. We did it in the Tutsis and the Hutus in Rwanda. In our country, we've done the same thing with a certain class of folks, demeaned them for so long to make it easy to put these horrible criminal justice ties around these folks that have decimated individuals' lives and communities. Look, if you're a parent in our country, I'm going to go ahead and say it, an African-American, you've been arrested, the chances of you getting a job are slim to none. That means the impact on your kids and your children and generationally, we see it now. We've seen it in America. And so we need to really look at this, and we need to understand that the myth that's been perpetrated, that this is a moral issue, is wrong.
We are getting so many emails and tweets about this topic. Here is one tweet. Certainly addiction is an issue. However, the correction system is propped up on low-level cannabis offenders. Rob tweets the show, we should prosecute the manufacturer and the high-level traffickers, provide treatment for users and low-level traffickers. And we're getting a lot of emails and comments on our Facebook page, Kevin, asking us if Attorney General Jeff Sessions has financial ties to the private prison industry. Lots of comments and questions coming in about that. So as you were talking and I was seeing all this come in, I looked on the nonpartisan website, Snopes.com, and here is their answer to that. Attorney General Sessions does have shares in two funds that include holdings in two leading private prison companies. However, these are widely diversified funds, and his income from them is relatively low, meaning he does not stand to gain financially in any meaningful way if the private prison industry increases in value. His investments do not fall afoul of conflict of interest rules. Just wanted to clarify that. A lot of people wanted to know that. Okay, let's go to Wells in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Wells.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I need to talk a little bit about how this is a package deal with Sessions regarding the African-American community. As you all know, he is rolling back the attempts in different states to hold police accountable for killings. And he just released the officer who killed Alton Sterling. This is a signal, should be a signal, a wake-up call to the African-American community that what is at stake here is, and what is happening, basically, is a reinforcement of institutionalized racism by Jeff Sessions. This war on drugs is basically going to be stepped up in the black community, in the brown community, And also, they will sweep up poor whites. So what we're seeing here is a nation that will not finance programs to help people who are on drugs, but will build more prisons and lock more people up. Thank you.
Kevin Gay.
The caller's right on. I mean, it's that's what we really need to be, you know, cautious about. I think my hope in our community is that when we begin to move like we have been moving, and you see what our state attorney's doing, and the collective body of all of our folks coming together to address these issues are going to have the biggest impact on race relations in our community.
Yeah, you've seen State Attorney Melissa Nelson really take her office more in the direction of what you're talking about in terms of these smart justice reforms, as they're called. And getting bipartisan buy-in. So let me ask you then, can the local state and district attorneys, can the states, you know, how much leeway do the states and municipalities have to depart from whatever the attorney general is laying down as his policy?
Well, there are guidelines on drug charges that they all have to follow. And if it escalates to, you know, a certain level, it then becomes a state charge and a federal charge. And so, you know, I think that's where beforehand, when Attorney General Holder had rolled back, he gave some flexibility in that. And he, in his directive that I brought with me, his directive said, we want to give the states and the local municipalities the opportunity to deal with that on a local level because we think it's more effective to do that on a federal level. I worry that if that's taken away and we get back to that, I've had numerous judges here in town say, we feel horrible. We feel like our hands are tied because we really don't have the flexibility and the authority anymore to really use the deference that we have and the wisdom that we have to make those determinations. And so, look, we are all excited about the role that our state attorney and our public defender have on this. We would hate to see that be lost.
There's one example that's been cited recently out of Tennessee. A former federal judge says he was forced to sentence a low-level drug dealer to life in prison. He refused to take a plea deal and was convicted at trial under these new guidelines. So what you're saying, Kevin, is life sentences for someone who is at a very low level and perhaps could be rehabilitated, you're arguing against that. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, use reason. I mean, if it's somebody who, Melissa, that has just been in and out, and they're dealing drugs and they're selling, look, we've got it. Public safety has got to be at the forefront of all these conversations. But when you look at that example, look, we had a woman a couple years ago, Melissa, a mother and a daughter that had a charge of $500 in crack cocaine, served 10-year sentences. Now, that's a really big drug dealer, right? It's insane. And so I think in a situation like we have with the example you gave, and somebody had a drug charge, you know, and then now, maybe 20 or 30 years later, a small possession charge could lead and trigger that third strike piece that you're talking about.
Let me ask you on the other hand. I'm going to go back quite a ways. Do you remember Michael Fay? The kid that got caned in Singapore. Remember that?
Yeah, absolutely.
He was this American kid. I remember this because he was from Dayton, Ohio, and that's where I grew up. He was in Singapore, got picked up by the police there, had some drugs on him, was publicly caned. What would you say to those who might argue, hey, people aren't dealing drugs in Singapore? You can't even pick up a piece of gum off the street in Singapore because they'll cane you or they'll throw you in jail if you so much as litter. They don't have an open society the way we do. But you know what? For more authoritarian-leaning Americans who like Sessions policies, what would you say to them?
I'm going to fall in the category of what Pew found recently, in that 84% of Americans, regardless of their political affiliation, agree that incarceration is too costly and that money should be redirected to local community programs. That's what we're not doing. We need to invest in the social infrastructure to help address the issue. Let's find out what's driving those issues as opposed to hanging them upside down and beating their feet like they did in that horrible situation. You know, the outcomes have been the same. We've been treating people exactly like they have in Singapore. It's just looked different. But the outcomes have been devastating, just as they have been there.
And then lastly, how can people learn more and help your efforts with Operation New Hope?
I mean, I would love for folks just to become more aware about what's out there. Because I guarantee you, we speak in community groups and churches all the time. In every single event we go to, Melissa, we have people coming to us talking about a cousin, a child, a neighbor. I've got family members. Look, the issues of drug and mental health issues run so rampant, but for some reason in our country, we're so embarrassed to talk about them. And so these issues go unresolved, untreated, and folks end up in the dark trying to deal with those issues and end up in our criminal justice system. And so I know we can do better. I would invite anybody to come to our office and see what we do. We would love to be involved. I'm so grateful that our community has supported this work. We're able to address a lot more people than ever before. And I know we've got way more jobs right now than we actually have folks in our program. And so our community has stood up. You know, we were the first city to ban the box. Our chamber has led.
You led on that. You led that effort nationally. Ban the box effort, so that people applying for jobs don't have to say whether or not they've had a conviction.
Their, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, so the city has stood with us. You know, Councilman Kevin Hyde at the time wrote that with me, and then our chamber recently, by the leadership of Daniel Davis and Darnell Smith and Audrey, the first chamber in America to really promote the fact that companies need to really move in step. So we've got now employers willing to do. The statistics I was reading before I came in this morning is that 9 out of 10 employers in America still ban the box, ask that question. So when you think about those great barriers, 3 out of 5 colleges ask about, you know, do you have a record? Most public housing authorities now ask if you have a record. So when you think about all those great barriers that are lined in front of people, it's no wonder why we have folks staying in the system.
He's right on Main Street in Springfield. Go see him. Kevin Gay, CEO of Operation New Hope. Thanks for being with us.
It's always a pleasure, Melissa. Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later weekend events with The Spectator. A live report from Clay County as they get ready for their concert on the green this Memorial Day. But up next, why May is a good month to get your child's hearing checked. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Yeah, I'm first generation, and my parents are immigrants. And if you know anything about immigrants, they love secrets. They love bottling them up deep down inside of them, and then unleashing them on you 30 years later when it's no longer relevant. And you're like, what? Mom's a communist? Dad's a ninja? Why are you telling me this right now? Like,
join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, June 3rd from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
On the next Jazz Night in America, bassist Buster Williams.
I knew early on that bass was what I wanted to do. I didn't know how difficult it was going to be, but after I convinced my father to teach me, there was no way of backing out.
After laying down the low end for more than 5 decades and 250 recordings, Buster brings his band Something More to Jazz and Lincoln Center. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, May is Better Speech and Hearing Month. And if you can hear this, great. We also, though, want to give you a gentle reminder. Get your hearing checked and make sure your kids get theirs checked too. Mike Howland, president and CEO of the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center, says parents need to be looking out for certain patterns in their child's speech. And he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yes, very important. And not only for children all ages that people are getting their hearing checked, May being Better Hearing and Speech Month is a just kind of a great reminder to do it on an annual basis. But Children in particular, parents can often be unaware that their child has a hearing problem. I talked to a mom recently who learned from her teacher that from her daughter's teacher that her daughter had been doing well in class in the topics where she was straight addressing the class. Turns out that she was able to lip read her teacher. And then when the teacher was writing on the board and talking, she couldn't hear a thing. So children can have hearing loss for any number of issues. It can stem from birth. It could be anything, kind of childhood diseases, ear infections, all sorts of things. So it's important to get it checked every year.
Yeah, because that's something that can kind of creep up in a subtle way. The parent may not really realize what's going on at first. Now, it is Better Speech and Hearing Month, so not only should you have your kids checked out, people need to have themselves checked out.
Yeah, it's a good reminder for all of us to get that hearing checked. And even more importantly, if there are hearing deficits, to get them treated. Older adults, those of us who hit that little 50-60 mark, all of us are likely to experience some degree of hearing loss, and just putting off dealing with it or getting the hearing solutions that are necessary can just lead to a deteriorating lifestyle, you know, lack of communications, interactions with family members, difficulties on the job, and it can even lead to dementia and Alzheimer's.
And what's the link, Mike, between hearing loss and dementia?
Well, it's the Johns Hopkins, I think, came out with the first study, but there are others as well that have just verified the fact that if there is untreated hearing loss for or a period of time, that it can lead to dementia and Alzheimer's.
Okay. But the good news, though, is there are a lot of advances in technology that can help people as they age still continue to hear just great. Isn't that right?
The technology, when it comes to hearing aids, has advanced tremendously. And not only that, they are not as obvious as they used to be for people that are wearing them. I know some people get a little antsy about the fact that they've got a hearing aid showing. And it's really, something that now a lot of the hearing aids fit in the ears. The prices come way down. I know that we offer a hearing aid starting at $400. We even offer layaway. So there's really no excuse not to get that hearing tested and then treated.
You had a big bash the other night, FinFest. Tell us what happened.
We did. FinFest is our annual fundraiser and the capstone to Better Hearing and Speech Month. And we were able to net $155,000 for serving those.
That's a lot of hearing aids.
Yeah, it's and a lot of speech therapy, but it's really critical for us as a smaller nonprofit, one that doesn't get any government assistance, that we raise the money to support that portion of our patients that are uninsured and underinsured, and that's really more than half of them. So while we serve judges and athletes and others, we also serve a lot of people that might not be able to afford those solutions.
Sure, absolutely. So support the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center. And by the way, after 50 years in Springfield, you're moving.
We are. About August 15th, we will be moving to a more accessible location at 1010 North Davis Street, the Davis Center. If you want to think of it in these terms, we are smart sizing. It's not like we're upsizing or downsizing, but we're going to make more effective use of the space that we have. Like I said, very accessible to the confluence of I-10 and 95. We're going to make it more autism friendly. So we're really looking forward to that. Not that our location in Springfield didn't serve us well for a long time.
Sure. Now, how can people get in touch with you to have, how can they access these services, particularly, as you said, if they don't have insurance?
Well, the best thing is to call us at area code 904-355-3403. And the importance is to get in for an appointment. And first of all, we give free hearing screenings to anybody that wants to call and get a free hearing screening. Those that need more, if they cannot pay for it, do not have insurance, cannot qualify for Medicaid, we will figure out a way to help them. And that's the importance of events like FinFest.
He's Mike Halland, president and CEO of the Jacksonville Speech and Hearing Center. May is Better Speech and Hearing Month. Get your family's hearing checked. Mike, always great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, in a moment, we've got a holiday weekend coming up and lots of options for your fun. We'll tell you about it next.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, preventing another banking disaster. The Treasury Secretary is reversing course on supporting a rule to prevent another financial crisis. Senator Elizabeth Warren says that would lead America back to a place no one wants to go.
What exactly is the problem that they think they're trying to solve?
Senator Warren joins us next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Save the date for Girls' Day Out, Saturday, August 26, 2017 at the Hyatt Riverfront. Join us for a day of pampering and making time to care for you. Be inspired by health experts, free screenings, and great door prizes. Keynote speaker is Jennifer Berman, MD, co-host of the Emmy Award-winning talk show, The Doctors. Go to wjct.org/girlsdayout to register.
Today's segment with Carrie Speckman is brought to you in part by Blue Bamboo Asian Kitchen.
Welcome back. Well, it is a Memorial Day weekend tradition, an outdoor Under the Stars performance by the Jacksonville Symphony that celebrates the arts. Concert on the Green is coming up in Clay County. And if you've never heard about this, it's a lot of fun. Lauren Hoffman is president of Concert on the Green, and she's on the line now with a preview. Hey, Lauren, good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having us on your show.
Oh, sure. And what could be better than listening to the Symphony Under the Stars? Tell us what's going to be happening.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, just as you said, we're an outdoor music and arts festival. It's in Orange Park. We've been here for 30 years, so this is our 30th anniversary. And it's just a celebration of the art and music of our Jacksonville-Orange Park area. Our gates open at 4 p.m., and we have local musicians and bands on stage starting at 4. And, of course, as you mentioned, the Jacksonville Symphony is our headliner, if you will. And that downbeat's at 8 p.m. They're under a tent. Outdoors, bring a chair and a blanket. It's just a great night.
This is all happening this Sunday. And aren't there a lot of fireworks to kind of cap it all off?
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot of food trucks there, a slew of art activities for adults and kids, including, well, all kinds of things. But yes, after the Jacksonville Symphony performance today, we have about a 20-minute fireworks show that's just spectacular.
Yeah, I've heard it's really good, Lauren. And let's also point out that Concert on the Green is all about providing scholarships for students in the performing and visual arts. That's the fundraising piece, isn't it?
Absolutely. Our benefit, 100% of our tickets. We have no paid staff. We do this all locally. And so 100% of our ticket prices and everything goes directly to scholarships to kids in our community and to schools in our community for art and music.
Okay, so people need to mark their calendars now for this Sunday's Concert on the Green, the annual Under the Stars Symphony Concert. This is at St. John's Country Day School in Orange Park. Event kicks off at 4 o'clock Sunday with the concert at 8 o'clock. And, of course, you won't want to miss the fireworks. It's a beautiful night under the stars with the Jacksonville Symphony. Lauren Hoffman, your president of Concert on the Green. Have a great time out there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. And that is coming up Sunday. Meanwhile, we have lots of options for your Memorial Day holiday. From Britt Floyd to Tedeschi Trucks to Idina Menzel, the Commodores, Lots of music for your Memorial Day holiday. Here she is to take us all around town. We welcome the Mistress of Mayhem, the Maven of Mirth, the iPhone wielding and fidgeting with Carrie Speckman.
That's me.
Here today.
That's me.
You were setting up your phone as
I know. Wasn't that fancy?
Setting you up.
It's my little pop socket my friend
Heather
gave me.
You've got a little pop socket.
Look at it.
To prop
it's like a little easel. Fancy.
I like that.
With a kitty cat on it.
I may have to get one of those.
I know.
All right, my friend, we've got a 3-day weekend. Everyone's very excited, and there are lots to do.
So much. Tonight is the kickoff to the Jazz Fest with the jazz piano competition, and they will, four or five of them, I believe, compete. Mm-hmm. And the winner gets to play at the Jazz Festival on the big stage.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, and this is a 4-day festival all throughout the urban core. You need to go to jackssheriff.org to make sure you're aware of road closures all during Jazz
and
Fest.
There's a shrimp game.
The
and
shrimps
there's
are
some
playing.
Other concerts. There's things at Flora Theater, so you really need to go check that out.
Yeah, speaking of which, the new Daly's Place Amphitheater right across the street from WJCT opening up Saturday with the Tedeschi Trucks Band and then another concert Sunday with Train.
That is correct.
But this is big doings here in the sports complex.
Big. What is that?
That's Tedeschi Trucks.
Oh, I was like, yeah. Am I hearing voices?
Tedeschi Trucks. You know, Susan Tedeschi from the Northeast, but, you know, Derek Trucks is
former child prodigy.
Former child prodigy. He's the nephew of Butch Trucks from the Allman Brothers Band.
And he used to play with Lynyrd Skynyrd. Mm-hmm.
Big deal. And these are hometown heroes kicking off this amphitheater.
Very appropriate.
Yeah, so that's going to be excellent.
Saturday.
That's
yes.
Saturday.
Okay. And Train, yes.
Train on Sunday.
Correct.
Now, let's talk about Friday night, because if you're a fan of Frozen, like my daughters and many other people's daughters, you will be happy to know that Idina Menzel is coming Friday.
Who performs Let It Go, among other, I guess she was the, I didn't say it.
Yeah, here she is. Yeah, she's coming to the St. Augustine Amphitheater Friday night.
And of course she was in Wicked.
Oh, yeah. She's incredible. I mean,
she has been called
what a voice.
The Streisand of her generation, as a matter of fact.
I believe that's accurate,
oh,
my friend.
Oh, is this
friend.
Let It Go?
This is it.
Oh, see, shows how much I know.
Let it go, let it go.
Lucky for you, I don't know the words.
See, I do. I have,
I'm sure you do.
I have daughters.
Belt
I know
it
this
out.
Song by her.
Hey, I've seen you in Carpool Karaoke, lady. You should, belt it out.
I am not Idina Menzel. Let's just say that. Yeah. But she's coming Friday to the St. Augustine Amphitheater.
Yes.
Okay, more music. Britt Floyd is coming Friday.
Yes, they are. And they are obviously a Pink Floyd tribute band.
Where are they performing? People love them.
They're at the Florida Theater.
Florida Theater.
Yes.
Okay, Friday. We talked about the Jazz Festival.
We did. Also,
we talked about Daly's Place.
I want to throw in Jazz After Dark.
Okay.
Which is a lot of local venues, 1904, Bold City, Spliff's Gasho Pub, and they will be having music. I think they start around 8 usually.
Okay.
A lot of them, I think they're all local bands.
Also Saturday, it's the grand opening of the St. Augustine Aquarium.
Now, I do want to say I did a little research on this, and apparently this is a soft, it's been open, but it's a soft opening. It's not what you're picturing aquarium like the Atlanta Aquarium.
Okay.
It's a much smaller.
It's small, but nice.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, people who've been there love it, but just know it's not the Atlanta Aquarium.
Let me make a quick mention, too, about a May 27th cleanup effort on the neighborhoods between State, Church, and Broad Street and Hogan. Volunteers are getting trash bags and other tools to help with the city of Jacksonville's effort to clean it up and green it up.
And
that's
props,
pretty nice.
Props to council member Reggie Gaffney for pitching in as well.
Yeah, so some people are going to be engaging in some service over the Memorial Day holiday.
They are. Good for them.
All right. I need to also mention, because this is sort of a music-themed spectator
it really
segment,
is.
We have a ticket giveaway. Really exciting. Thank you to Brad Stevenson, who works upstairs here at WJCT, for providing these. Two free tickets for this weekend's Florida Folk Festival in White Springs. This is a great festival at the Stephen Foster Folk Culture Center State Park in White Springs. Now, if you want these two tickets, email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. The unimpeachable Kevin Mersharp will pick a winner at random.
That.
Because he's unimpeachable.
I know, but that's a word you'd never hear.
Anyway.
Except on here when there's a giveaway.
He will pick a winner at random. You'll have to come pick it up here at the station. So.
Super.
I've been holding these tickets in the studio for a week. Just waiting for you to come in here. Just waiting for you to come in here so
ta-da,
I can give them away.
Ta-da! I'm here. I also wanted to mention real quick, Memorial Concert and Picnic in the Park, Memorial Park Association. It's a free 2-hour concert, and the performers will include the U.S. Navy Band Southeast and the Don't Miss a Beat All-Stars. And it is a BYOFCOB event.
Yeah.
Which is bring your own folding chairs or blankets.
That's always a good... Every event should say that, don't you think?
You can't bring chairs into just any event. Bring them to Rockville.
That would not have flown with my family.
No, that's
how you know we're too old for Rockville, right?
I went to Rockville.
Did you bring a blanket?
No.
You were rocking out the whole time.
Just a Def Leppard, really.
All right. Go to thespectator.com and have fun whatever you do this Memorial Day.
So many things to do. But make sure you figure out the road closures or you're going to be... Also, the Skyway's open all day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Oh, good tip
like
there.
Like till 1:30 in the morning.
Very good tip. Use the Skyway this weekend and go to jackssheriff.org
Correct.
To check those road closures. And then also visit thespectator.com.
Right. Correct. It's been a pleasure and a mild inconvenience.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, President Trump has promised to do a big number on Dodd-Frank financial regulations. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.